that Israel is becoming more and more isolated. There's also an opposite trend, by the way, a series of proposals from various important segments in Israel arguing for a rapid settlement with the Palestinians based on a withdrawal to the 1967 lines. There is an unofficial Geneva Agreement which has been drawn up, which was negotiated on the Israeli side by Labor Party politician and Oslo Accords negotiator Yosef Beilin. People are saying it's so far tainted by its left-wing peacenik origins as to be significant. But probably the same could not be said of Ayalon Nosebek's statement of principles, which last week was endorsed by four former Shin Bet intelligence officials, including its author, Ami Ayalon, which called for a unilateral Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the division of Jerusalem. If you look at this from the overall viewpoint of Islamic militancy, this is really a remarkable change from being the heavies and the bad boys, starting with 9/11 in 2001, or if we even want to take it back to the first bombing of the World Trade Center there. The world as a whole largely is backing the Islamic point of view. Israel has now become the bad boy. And the United States is becoming more and more isolated in its viewpoints as well. Meanwhile, in these countries, the Western dictate of tolerance and diversity prevents any fair debate. Remember always, tolerance is not tolerant, diversity is not diverse. It only accepts its own type and brand of thinking. And it says such things, absolutely. Wow. Meanwhile, more rumblings out there. Fresh Al-Qaeda warnings of countdown to the terror network.
Stand here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I want to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And with us this evening is Kenneth Timmerman. We're going to be talking about his book, Preachers of Hate, Islam and the War on America. Mr. Timmerman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Stan, yeah.
Well, now, we talked to Mr. Timmerman this afternoon on one of our other broadcasts, but we were just getting to the point where you were about to tell us the story of what happened in Netanya. Would you like to tell that story?
Well, yes. Netanya was, I think, really a pivotal event in certainly the war on terror and the war that the Israelis are fighting against terror.
I think maybe Netanya is a seacoast town in Israel, sort of a resort town. We've been there, and I'm sure you have as well, and it's a nice, quiet, very desirable place. So, and one of the things that really amazed me as you told the story, I didn't know how you knew what the people were thinking until afterwards. So you tell the story and then explain, please, how you knew what the people were thinking as they carried out the various steps.
Sure. Well, what I tried to do in Preachers of Hate was to allow readers to get inside the mind a little bit of what a suicide bomber was actually thinking, and to follow the tracks of the bombers. He came sort of step by step close to the Park Hotel in Netanya. This was a particularly deadly attack. There are 29 people who were killed in this particular attack. He goes and he dresses up as a transvestite and goes into a hotel where people are gathering for the Passover Seder in March of 2002. And what I wanted to do was show, you know, how this guy is recruited a little bit, to show how he gets the bomb, how he, in the beginning, he didn't really know where he was going. You know, they were searching for a target. And at the same time, you watch the people coming into this hotel where they're going to meet for the family, this family gathering. For people who are not Jewish, and I'm not Jewish either, but something that I learned, you know, the Passover Seder is where families get together and you have sometimes four generations together. This particular Passover that was so murderous, there were people who had survived the Holocaust. They had, you know, survived Hitler's death camps. They had tattooed, you know, their numbers on their wrists from Auschwitz and other, of the death camps in Nazi Germany. But they weren't able to survive this particular bomber who'd been sent there by Yasser Arafat.
All right. Well, of course, do you want to get, just tell the story as it unfolded?
Sure. And the way that I learned about the bombers, there are two things that, two particular key pieces of information. One, I happened to interview two Palestinian suicide bombers before this event, and these were people that I had met in Gaza. The first one who actually went off 6 days after I had met him in a garage, where I was introduced to him by militants from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. He actually went off and strapped explosives around his waist and drove a bicycle into an Israeli checkpoint and murdered a few soldiers. And the other one was somebody I'd met in a prison in Gaza, where the Arafat security forces had arrested him, and they had caught him before he was able, obviously, to blow himself up. And
you're sort of cutting in and out. Are you on a regular hard telephone?
I am indeed. Yes, I am indeed here. Okay. He was in a prison, and he had been arrested by Arafat's people, and he was treated as a sort of special guest. He was not treated really as a criminal, and that was something, one of the things that surprised me. But these people told me about their motivation. They told me how they hated Jews. They told me how they really lived for one thing only, which was to murder Jews. And the other piece of information that I used, the other source of information, was the transcript from the trial of some of the accomplices of the person, Abdul Basit al-Odeh, who actually carried out this particular bombing in Netanya. And so they described step by step, moment by moment, of the bombing and especially the preparation for the bombing. It's really quite chilling when you read those transcripts word by word, as I did.
And of course, this one gentleman shaved off his beard and went in dressed as a woman.
Yes, he dressed, and one of the people who survived the bombing said to me, "Well, she turned to her husband." And she said, "Well, I thought he was a transvestite." and the husband said, "No, I just thought he was French," as he was coming into the, because there was a hotel where a lot of French people came normally. And it was really, you know, just sort of macabre, this kind of detail. And you see that the Israelis who were coming to this Passover Seder, they were expecting innocence. I mean, they were coming there with their children, their grandchildren, coming to see old people who had survived the Holocaust, and they could not possibly imagine that someone could be preparing to do such an evil deed. And they saw this person come in, either the bomber, and they said, "Oh no, he's just a young French transvestite, and he's perhaps sort of, you know, wanting to make amends with his parents for his sexual deviance." But no, he was coming there to murder people.
And I think what's so difficult for the average individual to understand is this intense hatred, knowing you're going to kill yourself, and yet you just want to take a lot of people with you. I mean, it's difficult for the average person living in America to understand this degree of hatred, this degree of dedication, and this whole idea that life means absolutely nothing. You're going to go to paradise once you've killed yourself, killing the enemy. This is not the attitude that you'd find among the Jewish people, certainly not among Americans.
No, absolutely correct. And it's something, I think that's, you know, certainly one of the things that is the most difficult to understand. It's one of the reasons that I wrote this book, because I thought that Americans really did need to understand the way that these people think, because they are dedicated murderers. They've been trained to murder. They've been brought up to murder. And they believe that they are really following a higher calling, and that they will go to heaven. They will be greeted by 72 virgins in heaven. And murder is God's vision for them for life. It's really quite stunning.
One of the things you bring out in your book is the fact that most of the Palestinians live in filth and squalor, but they blame the Jews for that. Now, Yasser Arafat has been given billions of dollars to help the people, and he squirrels this away in his own bank accounts, and yet you told the story of the hotel in Gaza. Would you mind telling that? Because I think it sort of epitomizes the mindset of the Palestinian.
Yeah, well, this was about 3 years after Arafat had come to Gaza in 1994, and they had managed to build a series of very nice hotels along that beachfront there, and it's a beautiful place. If you see photographs of the beach in Gaza, you say, wow, this is really lovely, and they could make it into a wonderful resort, but they hadn't done so. And I was out one evening, the first evening I had gone back there, and just jogging along the seacoast. And, of course, the seacoast was not as one might have suspected, and it was full of filth and sewage and the rest. And I got back to the hotel, and I just kind of wondered, and I talked to the owner, and I said, well, why don't you clean this up? You know, you have such a wonderful beachfront, and why don't you make it into something even more beautiful? And he said, no, we cannot do anything. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, because of the Israelis. I said, no, wait a second. The Israelis have been gone here for 3 years. He said, no. The Israeli occupation. I said, no, this is not possible. There are no Israelis here. You're running things yourselves. And he said, no, we can do nothing because of the Jews.
In other words, it's all the Jews' fault that we haven't bothered to clean up our own beaches.
That's right.
Even though the Jews have been gone for 3 years.
Yeah, and I said, well, why don't you just hire some neighborhood kids and pay them $1 an hour or $1.50 an hour? He said, no, we can't do that because of the Jews.
And everything is attributed to the Jews, and this intense hatred within the Palestinians for the Jews, and of course everything the Palestinians do in the way of bombings causes the Israelis to hate the Palestinians. And so you have this condition over there of just seething hatred on both sides, although the Israelis have made amazing concessions. In fact, they've given most of the land, most of the West Bank, back to the Palestinians. In fact, if you were to estimate how much land they've given back, how much land have the Israelis given to the Palestinians in return for the promise of peace?
Well, it's roughly about 98% of those Palestinian areas which they have given back through this so-called peace process. And, you know, Oslo in 1993 was supposed to be a deal where the Israelis would give land to the Palestinians that they had seized during the 1967 war, and the Palestinians would, in return, give them peace. And so the Israelis have given land over to them, and Arafat's been in charge, and instead he's given them murder and mayhem. And I think this is really one of the tragedies of this peace process.
In fact, isn't Arafat really one of the major people who's pushing the Islamic terrorist movement there and encouraging this sort of fanatic bombing?
Yes, Arafat is indeed pushing it. And the Israelis, you see, after that bombing in Netanya, which I described, the Israelis went into the West Bank with their army, and they particularly focused on headquarters of the Palestinian Authority and of the different Palestinian terrorist organizations, and they seized millions of pages of documents. And I was able to access some of those documents in Israel, and I talked to the intelligence analysts who were poring over them. And it was you know, quite startling and very, very clear what was going on. You had letters that Arafat had signed in his own hand where he is authorizing payment to suicide bombers for their attacks to kill Jewish civilians. Now, you've got to remember, folks, that these are not military operations. These are kids who are 18, 19, 20 years old. They strap explosives around their chest, and they go into restaurants, they go into discotheques, they go into cafes, they go into places of leisure, they go into supermarkets, they just walk down the street in Jewish areas just to kill Jews. And Arafat was paying money to them, he was giving orders to them, and the Israelis actually found the documents, and they showed me many of these documents. It was absolutely conclusive what was going on.
But the disturbing part of this whole story is we're financing Arafat.
Yes, well, yes, that's indeed true, too.
And now, one of the things we pointed out on, I thought in the last program, was really so fascinating, is that one of the things that's recruiting young people into the Islamic terrorist movement in Palestine was the textbooks that are used there, which you had mentioned were provided by USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. And weren't these actually pushing this radical form of Islamic hatred?
Well, that's right, and the story of the textbooks is quite interesting because when the Israelis seized the West Bank and Gaza in 1967 in the Six-Day War, they inherited these areas, and they had to take care of the civilian population. So they looked at the school books that were provided by the Egyptian and by the Jordanian authorities, and they found all this anti-Semitic filth in the books, and they took it out, and they reprinted the school books. Well, Arafat, when he went back when he went in 1994 into Gaza and became the head of the Palestinian Authority, he took all that anti-Semitic filth and he put it back into the school books and reprinted them. And of course, as you mentioned, we paid through USAID, we paid to help those books reprinted and distributed to Palestinian children, where they learned, you know, that Jews were the sons of monkeys and pigs, and they learned to hate Jews from the ages of 5, 6, and 7 in their public schools.
And the thing is that the older Palestinians, many of them are not as radical, but it's the youth who are being indoctrinated with this hatred, and they're the ones, of course, who are going into the Jewish section and blowing themselves up and perpetuating this. How can we possibly put an end to this? Because, as you point out in your book, this has nothing to do with land. This has to do with destroying the Jewish people and driving them off. They will never be happy. They could have all the land, and they still wouldn't be happy.
Yes, well, that's right. And we see this, the further this so-called Oslo peace process continues, is that the more land that the Israelis give to them, the more of these murderous suicide or homicide bombings occur. And you just have to conclude that this is not about land. This is not about a rational process. We're not talking about rational people. If it were about land, they could negotiate it. But it's not about land. It's about Arafat's phased plan. And this is something that I reproduce in the book, In Preachers of Hate. It's something that's been going on for really quite some time. And the PLO set it out in 1974 in a document. It's called the PLO Phased Plan for the Takeover of Palestine. And bit by bit, they talk about how they will first take a portion of territory, establish a national authority in that territory. That's what you have today in Gaza and the West Bank. And then gradually they will take over more territory from Israel until eventually they succeed in destroying the Israeli state and establishing Palestine in all of what is today Israel.
But as you point out, they've already been given 98% of the land there, thanks to our policies. And you point out in your book that one of the heads of the Israeli security had gotten videos or motion pictures of Arafat. Of course, when he talks to the American people, he talks in English, and he talks about peace. When he talks to the Palestinians in Arabic, he talks about the jihad, he talks about killing the Jews. And the head of the security gave this to Peres, who was the president, I guess he was there, came in, what, just before Rabin was assassinated, just after.
Right. Well, this was just after Rabin was assassinated.
And so the head of security gives this to Peres and says, "Look, this is what Arafat is saying. You know, he's saying, talking out both sides of his mouth. He's really advocating jihad and killing the Jews." And what does Peres do?
Well, Peres says, "Oh no, this can't possibly be true. These speeches that you claim to have videotaped are all forgeries, aren't they, Mr. President?" As he turns to Arafat. And Arafat turns back and says, "No, these are actually my words. this is exactly what I said, because they had videotape of Arafat making his speeches. And Peres just doesn't know what to say at that point. And Arafat says, well, no, this is exactly what I was saying, but you must understand that jihad does not mean murder.
That of course, but it does. It means it's war. It's the holy war. Certainly, Arafat knows that, and Peres must know that. I do not believe these people are that stupid.
No, but of course. But they were in this pact together, and I think this is one of the tragedies of the so-called Middle East peace process, is that you have people, especially on the Israeli side and on the American side of this, who understand full well what's going on, that Arafat has set out to murder the Jews and has set out to destroy the state of Israel, and yet they continue to negotiate with him. They continue to treat him as a partner for peace. And Arafat is seeking one thing only, that is the destruction of Israel, and you have people in Israel who want to commit suicide, basically. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
But isn't the American government putting tremendous pressure on the Israeli government to make the concessions?
Yes, and just in the past couple of weeks, we've seen, I must say, to my great dismay, we've seen the Bush administration start to do the same thing. I was really quite shocked to see Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, go to Geneva just now and meet with Yossi Beilin, a former Labor Party minister, and Yasser Abed Rabo, who is a former Palestinian minister, who have a so-called peace plan, which is really just Oslo. It's a version of the Oslo peace plan of 1993, and neither of these people belong to either government today, and yet our Secretary of State goes there to put his imprimatur on them. It's quite astonishing, and I think very unfortunate.
Well, when we get back, we're going to have to take a little break, and I want to talk about some of the other countries over there, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, all of these countries where anti-Semitism really is refined, and most of the people in key positions believe in a document called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is really a key to understanding not only why the Arabs have this intense hatred of the Jews, but why the Germans did, why the Russians did. And we're going to talk about this incredible document, which unfortunately is a forgery, but it's had a profound and effect on what's going on in that area today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Kenneth Timmerman. His book is called The Preachers of Hate, Islam, and the War in America. And really, to understand what's going on, you have to understand the protocol. So would you like to tell our listeners, and remember, this is an entirely different audience than you've talked to before, so don't be afraid to repeat yourself, because these issues are important. What is the protocols? Why is this document having such a profound impact on Arab-Jewish relations?
Well, the protocols of the Elders of Zion were written by the Secret Service, the intelligence service of the Russian Tsar in the late 19th century, and they were intended to demonstrate that Jews were basically responsible for every single evil that existed in the world at that time. They said that the Jews were socialists, they created wars and revolution and whatever. But it was a clever forgery. I mean, they had taken earlier texts and manipulated them. But what's interesting here is that certainly all people who have looked at this, scholars who have looked at this in the West and elsewhere, were very quick to find out where it came from and to see that this was a fabricated book. Now, what it says is that there is it claims to be the actual minutes of the meetings of the wise men of Zion as they got together to set out their plan for taking over the world. So it's the plot of alleged Jewish world conspiracy, a total fabrication and total fiction. In the 1920s and 1930s, it was introduced for the first time into the Arab and Muslim Middle East. And interestingly, it was conveyed by a person who was at that point the Grand Mufti, the highest religious authority in Palestine. His name was Hajj Muhammad Amin al-Husseini. And Hajj Muhammad Amin is an extremely pivotal character in the history of the Middle East, because when World War II began, he becomes an ally of the Axis powers.
In other words, of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini.
That's right. And as the British come into the Middle East, he flees, and first he goes to Italy, he meets with Mussolini, and then in November 1941, he is in Berlin, where he meets Adolf Hitler. And that meeting really changed, in my opinion, the history of the modern Middle East, because at that point, Hitler says, well, you are my man. You know, I am going to adopt your cause, and Haj Muhammad Amin said, I will adopt your cause. And he becomes the voice in Arabic of Adolf Hitler on Radio Germany. And he exhorts his Muslim followers to carry out in the Middle East Hitler's final solution. And he says, we will do here in the Middle East to the Jews what Hitler is doing to them in Europe. After the war, and Haj Muhammad Amin, by the way, he stays with Hitler up until the very end, and the French help him escape from Berlin as Berlin is falling to the Allied powers in 1945, and he escapes first to Paris and then ultimately to Cairo. And in the during the 1948 war of Israel's independence, he becomes the rallying force, the leader of the Arabs of Palestine. They didn't call themselves Palestinians yet. And so he's sitting in Cairo and rallying these Arabs of Palestine, and we find out, and this I thought was really quite something, we find out that one of his top students and adherents, if you wish, is a young man at Cairo University named Mohammed Abdul Rahman Abdul Rauf Arafat Al-Qudwa Al-Husseini.
Hang on just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Kenneth Timmerman, his book, Preachers of Hate, and we've been talking about the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the Grand Mufti, who really is more or less the ruler of all the highest ranking cleric within the Islamic world, who during the Second World War aligned himself with Adolf Hitler and was actually doing radio broadcasts in Germany to the Islamic world, encouraging them to carry out Hitler's plan of extermination of the Jews. And so you sort of pick up the story, and you were telling us about one of his students.
Yes, and his prize student, was a young man, Mohammed Abdul Rahman Abdul Rauf Arafat Al-Qudwa Al-Husseini, who was really enthralled by all these stories of the Nazis and wanted to carry them out themselves. Today he's known as Yasser Arafat. And Arafat learned everything that he knew about hating Jews and about exterminating Jews from the Grand Mufti, who sometimes he claims he is the Grand Mufti's nephew. And he went on to carry out that philosophy as he became the leader of the Palestinians.
And certainly another man who was very, very prominent, at least in Egypt, and embraced this Nazi philosophy was a man named Anwar Sadat.
Yeah, it's an amazing story about Anwar Sadat. You know, Sadat we think of as the peacemaker and president of Egypt who went to Jerusalem in 1977, gave this wonderful speech that won him the Nobel Prize. Well, you start to actually look at that speech very carefully, and it wasn't quite a speech of peace. It was quite a coded speech. He did not use the word for peace in Arabic. He used a word for truce, basically. And interestingly, Sadat, when he goes to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, and he speaks with Menachem Begin, the Israeli prime minister, during that visit in 1977, he's photographed wearing a tie, which is, the Israelis were polite enough not to remark upon. It was a tie of inverted swastikas from top to bottom. And you find out, as I found out in the book, in Preachers of Hate, I tell the story of how in his youth, that Sadat had been an admirer, not just of Hitler, but he had written a letter to, as a young officer, to one of the leading Egyptian dailies, when there were rumors that Hitler was still alive and in hiding in Argentina. He had written a letter to this daily of how he thought that really Hitler had won the war and had beaten that old dog Churchill, and how the Arabs were going to carry out his work and exterminate the Jews.
And so you see this strong Nazi element within the entire Arab world, the Muslim world of the Middle East. And not only that, what's so disturbing is that, after Sadat and Then Mubarak comes to power. We have been funding Egypt for I don't know how many years, to the tune of $2 or $3 billion a year, maintaining this authoritarian structure there, which is actively promoting anti-Semitism. You point out that the press in Egypt today is really controlled, even though the government denies it, but they control all the government dailies, and they're just spewing out anti-Semitism and all these incredible stories about the Jews killing Arabs or Christians to get their blood to mix in with the Passover bread.
That's right. And just last year at Ramadan, which is their month of fasting in the autumn, it usually occurs, they had a 40-part soap opera based on the protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was dramatized, you know, so it would appeal to people. People watch a lot of television during Ramadan, and families are together before they're able to eat in the evening. And this soap opera based on this myth of the Elders of Zion getting together and setting out their plan to take over the world, included scenes such as you just mentioned of the ritual murder of non-Jewish children so they could capture the blood to make their Passover matzah. Total forgeries. This is the most ancient blood libel that there is, really. And President Mubarak was asked about this by a number of members of the United States Congress. And Mubarak, who's supposed to be our ally, he wrote back to them. He said, "Well, there's nothing anti-Semitic about this broadcast at all."
The thing that really is brought out in the book is that this anti-Semitism permeates every aspect of the Middle East. It permeates the Saudi Arabia, it permeates the other areas, but associated with the anti-Semitism is the idea that America is really under more or less Jewish control, and we are doing their bidding because we're the only country in the world stands behind them, and so their hatred of the Jews then is transformed to America. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Kenneth Timmerman. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is a very important book. We'll be carrying it at Radio Liberty. If you'd like to know more, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR if you'd like to know more about the preachers of hate. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you are listening to our program and you agree that there are problems, that there is a spiritual battle going on in the world today, that America is changing and changing dramatically, and there is a reason for what's going on, we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day by shortwave internet, radio stations across America, and of course by satellite. And we have people actually listening by satellite and all across America, and even on the internet in countries all throughout the world. It's always gratifying to hear from Leif over in Bergen in Norway, or we have listeners that we know on a regular basis over in Jerusalem who like to hear American talk radio that is not primarily anti-Semitic, because an awful lot of this is, or at least that's the inference behind what's going on today. So if you'd like to know more about our ministry, well, you can go to our website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And there you can listen to our radio programs on the internet 5 hours a day and really not get much of anything accomplished, but at least you'll get a good education and you'll hear lots of exciting authors as they put forward their views. Some we agree with, some we don't. But we want you to hear what they have to say, because you already know how I feel about things. And then we have our newsletters up there on the internet. And you can pull those down going back a number of years. Everything we have written, we have documentation for, and we hope that you'll pull down our newsletters, you'll copy them, and you'll get them out to other people. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will tell your friends about our radio programs, that you'll tell your friends about the website so they can go there as well. Again, that's www.radioliberty.com. And then if you're interested in learning more about Kenneth Timmerman's excellent book, Preachers of Hate, Islam and the War on America. Why, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. And we have a wonderful video. It's actually made up of film footage that's actually shown on Islamic television stations all throughout the Middle East. It's called The New Barbarians, and it's designed to recruit young people. I mean, you're talking about 6, 8, 10-year-old children to become Islamic bombers, to become suicide bombers. One of the most frightening things is called The New Barbarians video. You see that. You make you realize what we're really up against today. The average American say it could never happen here. And I would simply ask, why couldn't it happen here when this is what's being promoted to almost a quarter of the world's population? Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, and our listeners up there in the great Northwest are back with us once again. Our guest this evening, Kenneth Timmerman, his book, The Preachers of Hate, Islam and the War on America. If you have a question, or give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, one of the points you made is Saudi Arabia. Of course, Saudi Arabia is supposedly the great friend of the West, but aren't they really preaching the same sort of violent anti-Semitism and actually financing this Wahhabi terrorist movement?
Oh, well, absolutely. And in fact, the Saudis are among the origins of modern anti-Semitism in the Middle East. They have been, since 1979, spreading their doctrine of this Wahhabi doctrine around the world. And I think 1979 is a very important year, and I spent a lot of time on this in the book to tell people about two events that happened. The first is the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. And the Shah was a secular leader, and he was replaced, of course, by Ayatollah Khomeini, who went on and seized U.S. hostages in Tehran. And most people, I think, still remember that story. But what they don't know is that Khomeini introduced for the first time, actually, into Iran the protocols of the Elders of Zion and this anti-Semitic doctrine. And he, of course, introduced into the Middle East again this idea of suicide bombers, and trained the first suicide bombers in something like 7 centuries, who went out and murdered people in the name of Islam. In Saudi Arabia in 1979, what happened was a group of Wahhabi extremists took over the great mosque in Mecca and threatened the Saudi kingdom. Now, they were Islamists, okay? These were not people who were outside the kingdom. They were Saudis, they were Islamists. And the king understood, after he succeeded to retake the mosque, and there were something like 2,000 people who were killed in that event, he realized that if he wanted to keep the radical preachers of hate from threatening his throne, he had to finance them, and he had to give in to them. Basically, he had to placate them. So he spent billions of dollars helping the Wahhabi preachers to spread their doctrine around the world, building schools, which are called madrasas, in places like Pakistan and Sudan and Somalia and even here in the United States, in Europe as well. And he spent billions of dollars doing this. And these are the places where the terrorists who later joined al-Qaeda under Osama bin Laden were initially trained. And they were trained and financed by the Saudis. And the Saudis were seeking one thing and one thing alone, that was to sort of distance, if you wish, the terrorist threat from their own kingdom.
Well, now, one of the points you make is that there are about 1,400 registered mosques here in the United States, and the majority of those are financed and headed by Saudi clerics who are pushing this radical Wahhabi, hate America religion.
That's right, and what's kind of interesting about that is that most American Muslims are not Wahhabis. I mean, they have nothing to do with Saudi Arabia, and they don't identify themselves with this Wahhabi doctrine of anti-Semitic and anti-American doctrine. And yet it's the Saudis, quite correctly, who control about 80% of those mosques in America.
Yeah, well, every once in a while you'll get somebody like, what was the name, Walker, the young...
John Walker Lind.
Right, John Walker Lind, who, you know, impressionable young people can be swept up in this because it sounds so good, it gives you something really to believe in. Here's the absolute truth, the Jews are the enemy, the Americans are the enemy, and it's difficult, I think, for the average American to believe that an American would actually go over to the Middle East and join the Taliban or some other Al-Qaeda movement with the idea of destroying America. But if you adopt this religion, this becomes part of your very essence of your belief.
Well, at least this radical version of Islam, which is becoming, unfortunately, increasingly mainstream in countries like Saudi Arabia, in countries like Syria, in countries like Egypt, Iran, Yemen, and elsewhere. Even in a place like Qatar, which is where the United States is now basing our forces, we've pulled our forces out of Saudi Arabia, and we've moved the CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command forces in the Persian Gulf region, into Qatar. Even Qatar is it's Wahhabi-dominated. Quite interestingly, it is the emir of Qatar who claims to be Western-oriented, who has been financing Al Jazeera Television, which at Insights Magazine, where I also work, we call this sort of with a wink and a nod, Jihad TV. These are the people who are glorifying the Ba'athist remnants in Iraq who are murdering American troops, and these are the same people who were glorifying Osama bin Laden when he was murdering Americans on 9/11.
Yeah, but, of course, the Islamic radicals are also at a majority in Algiers, and they won the election there. If it hadn't been for the military, they would have taken over. I suspect this is true in Turkey. I suspect this is true in Pakistan. And if Musharraf's government ever falls, why, the Islamics will be there, and they will have the bomb, and it'll be a whole new ball game.
Well, Pakistan is a particularly scary story, and I tell a couple of stories about Pakistan in Preachers of Hate, because I was tracking Osama bin Laden into Pakistan and from there into Afghanistan in 1998. You have senior people in the army and in the intelligence service, the ISI in Pakistan, who are Wahhabis, basically, and who support Osama bin Laden, and who trained bin Laden, and who are helping him today to escape from the United States and escape from the people who would like to bring him to justice. And it's really only Musharraf, the military ruler and now elected president, who is standing in the way of those people taking over Pakistan and turning Pakistan into a terrorist state.
Did you run into this gentleman, Ahmed, I think it is, General Mohammed Ahmed, who was who was the head of the ISI at the time of the bombing?
I did not meet him. Well, there were a number of people at the ISI that I did meet, and you know, the ISI was very sympathetic to Osama bin Laden because they had trained him and helped him. And I think that you're referring to the man who was in the United States at the time of the September 11th bombings, and who was later reported to have personally transferred $100,000 to the 9/11 bombers in the United States. And this is a story that hasn't yet been fully elucidated, and I would certainly hope that the September 11th investigative commission in Congress would get to the bottom of.
Well, at least the story is that he sent $100,000 ahead of wire to Muhammad Atta. So
that's right.
It makes you wonder why he would have done that and why he was in the Washington, D.C. on the day of the bombing. Well, let's go to Nathan, who's calling in here from Contra Costa. Hi, Nathan. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm very, very happy with the program today. Very good.
I thought you would be.
Oh, it's excellent. You know, I was shocked to turn on my news and read the newspaper and discover that Colin Powell was going to give some consideration to this Geneva peace plan. You know, I was told or sort of warned that this was going to be what the New World Order was going to force onto the Middle East, and voila, suddenly, in spite of all expectations, he goes to the meeting. Yeah, this may be somewhat off topic, but I don't think it really
is.
Well,
you have a question for our guest.
Yes, it is. To what extent does Colin Powell almost seemed to operate as like a veto on the Bush administration when, particularly on Middle East issues? It almost seems as though he directs policy. Does he direct policy, or does the White House direct policy?
Well, Nathan, that's a very good question, and I don't have an easy, quick answer for you. All I can tell you on that is that, you know, there's a great debate in this administration, and I am very close to people on all sides of that debate. And Powell, this was an extremely disputed decision, and Powell basically took it upon himself to go and speak with people in Geneva who are not in the government in Israel or in the Palestinian Authority, and who have this so-called peace plan, which is flawed. I mean, we know the details of it. It's Oslo II, if you wish. It's the same thing that we had in 1993 that led to all the murders of Jews and of Americans. And basically what he did, Colin Powell bypassed the elected government of the State of Israel on behalf of a rejected politician, Yossi Beilin, who involved foreign governments in Switzerland and other places in negotiating a peace treaty, which would be kind of like having Al Gore going to the United Nations and negotiating the terms of the U.S. Of the entry of the United Nations into Iraq. I mean, this is absolutely absurd. And why Colin Powell went and did this is totally beyond me.
Okay, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Is it possible that what we're dealing with is the real power inside the Bush administration? Is that?
No, I think Nathan, to be fair on this, I think this administration, like previous administrations, has several viewpoints within it. And, you know, there's always a battle within U.S. administrations. That's why we're a democracy. And you have people in the White House who clearly reject this, and you have people in the Pentagon who clearly reject this. If Colin Powell had been in charge of things, we never, I believe, would have gone to war in Iraq, and we never would have done a lot of things. So this is Powell's turn, if you wish.
What about the President of the United States?
Okay, well, thanks so much for calling, Nathan. And let's get back to some of the other things that in your book, as you go into the background of how the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion are really being pushed and being published. And really the most interesting thing was that many of the people you spoke to were very well educated. They were professional people. They spoke impeccable English. Some of them were, I remember one of them was a pediatrician.
That's right.
But they were scholars, and yet these Islamic scholars honestly believe that the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion are a valid document. They believe that the Jews control the monetary system of the world, they control the media of the world, and they really are a force intent upon not only dominating the world, but killing off the Arabs.
It's really quite stunning, Stan. I mean, the first time that I ran into this, I couldn't quite believe what I was hearing. When Abdelaziz Rantisi talked to me about the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and when Ahmed Bahar, these are both Hamas leaders, you know, pulled out his copy of it and read to me from it. You know, let me just read you this very, very quickly. This is from the Hamas charter. Hamas is the group in Gaza and the West Bank, the radical Islamic group that is murdering Jews and murdering Americans. And they have adopted the protocols of the Elders of Zion as their guidebook, so to speak. And this is what they say in their charter. It could have been written, it could have been copied directly from Mein Kampf, if you wish. They say, our enemies have planned from time immemorial in order to reach the position they've obtained now. They strive to collect enormous material riches to be used in the realization of their dream. With money, they've gained control of the international media, beginning with news agencies, newspapers, and publishing houses. And with their money, they have detonated revolutions in different parts of the world. This is amazing. Listen to this. The Jews were behind the French Revolution and the Communist Revolution, and were also responsible for most of the revolutions we've heard about elsewhere. With their money, they have created secret organizations which spread through the world in order to destroy societies and to achieve the Zionist interest. And they go on to say that it's the Freemasons, the Rotary, the Lions Club. They started World War I. They started World War II. They destroyed the Islamic Caliphate in Turkey. They even were behind the Holocaust. I mean, this is how insane this is. They claim that the Jews were even behind the Holocaust with the aim of creating the State of Israel.
Well, now, that would be the Zionists would be behind the Holocaust, not Jews. But
the Jews. When they say Zionists, they mean Jews. I mean, this is very clear. And And this is, it is totally insane. We are not dealing with a rational mindset. We're dealing with a conspiratorial mindset, which is prepared to believe that there's a secret world order and the Jews are behind it.
And yet, of course, many people wonder why the First World War, why America went into the First World War. There's so many things that go on in the world you can't explain. And, of course, here is a logical explanation. If you read the protocols, they actually talk. Of course, this is written, at the end of the 19th century, the 1890s, somewhere in there. But they talk about how they have actually created the revolution. So the Arabs are simply picking up on this idea and accepting it is true.
Yes, which came from Europe, and it's important to state this. I mean, the original anti-Semitic myths did not come from the Middle East. They came from Europe, and then they were transplanted to the Middle East, where Muslim radicals picked them up quite voluntarily. Now, I also spend quite some time in Preachers of Hate looking at how Europe has, there's been a recrudescence, a renewal of anti-Semitism in Europe. Attacks on synagogues in France and attacks on Jews in Belgium and in Britain, in Norway and elsewhere. And this is something that most people had thought was over for good with the end of World War II and the death camps. They thought never again could it be possible for Jews to be murdered in Europe. And I conclude in this book from talking to people who've been the victims of some of these attacks that unfortunately it can happen again, and that Jews, for the first time in 60 years, are afraid again in Europe.
Well, I think that they might very well be afraid here in the United States, because I talk to a lot of people, and there is a resurgence of anti-Semitism right here in the United States.
Yeah.
Much more so now than even 3 or 4 years ago.
Absolutely true, and it's particularly true on college campuses, but it's also true throughout the society. You know, the Department of Justice tracks anti-Semitic hate crimes around the United States, as well as anti-Islamic hate crimes around the United States. And if you listen to some of the Muslim groups in this country, I was quite amused. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, put out a press release just recently saying that anti-Muslim hate crimes are up by 500% or something like that. It's a total fabrication. You look at the statistics which have been released by the FBI, and anybody can go and get them on the FBI website. They're there for everybody to see. You can see that hate crimes against Muslims have gone down steadily since 2001. They were down last year by 11%, while hate crimes against Jews have gone up dramatically. They shot up in 2001 by 55%, and up last year they were 65% of the total. You had over 1,000 violent crimes against Jews in this country alone in 2001. So we are not, unfortunately, free of this kind of filth here in this country.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I really fear for my Jewish friends, because I feel this temple, especially if we get into some serious problems here in America economically, or people are always going to look for a scapegoat. And here, is a very, very convenient and very convincing document. If you read it through and you don't have a historical perspective, good people get swept up in this. And this, I think, was one of the things I learned from your book, is how prevalent the belief in the validity of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion was among literally all of the people you talked to. And you traveled throughout the Middle East, and apparently you've been traveling there extensively for some time, haven't you?
That's right, for about the past 20 years. And it's also, it's also still widespread in Europe. You know, here's something for you, Stan. You know, in France, we would think it's a modern country, it's a rational country. They pride themselves on creating logic, right, on Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. And yet, in France, just last year, they have, one of the bestsellers in France was written by a so-called journalist named Thierry Masson. And it claimed that there was no aircraft that crashed into the Pentagon that killed the people in the Pentagon. They said, "Oh no, it was a CIA plot with the U.S. military." And why did this journalist think this? Had he come to the United States? Had he looked at any investigative documents? Had he interrogated witnesses? Had he talked to people? No. He was sitting in France, and he was looking at internet pictures of the Pentagon, and he said, "Well, the hole in the Pentagon was too small for a 757 to go through, And they never found any debris that they published on the internet. So, of course, no aircraft ever hit the Pentagon. That book, this is going to show you how bad things are in France. That book sold over 250,000 copies in France, which on the scale of America, which is five times larger, would have been well over 1 million copies. Imagine that. This is real-time Holocaust revisionism, historical revisionism. No attack on 9/11. It was entire fiction. That's what some people in France believe.
Well, I think that there are reasons why some people are very uneasy about what happened on September 11th. But as I look at that book, No Plane Hit the Pentagon, and then I actually did a little research work on my own. I tracked down two people who would have no reason to lie to me, who saw the plane. A friend of mine tracked down six people who had actually seen the plane hit the Pentagon. So, the people actually saw the plane hit the Pentagon, and yet what this does, in my estimation, it distracts us from other serious questions that we might be asking, like, why did Building 6 and 7 go down, or other things. That, I think that there is so much information out there that is confusing, and I think the same thing was with the protocols. I think the protocols serve a very useful purpose, and that is distracting us from the very real issues that are going on today. And I think that this is one reason why they're actively being promoted, not only in the Islamic world, but they are being promoted all throughout the world, even to this very day.
That's right. Well, certainly in the Muslim Middle East, you know, the protocols of the Elders of Zion are being used to distract people from the total incompetence of Arab governments. I mean, you look at a country like Saudi Arabia, hundreds of billions of dollars in oil revenue over the past 30 years, and they can't even educate their own people to perform ordinary jobs. They have to import laborers and skilled workers from Pakistan, from India, from the Philippines, and other places. And while they have a 30% unemployment rate of their own people because they have no education, there's no excuse for this kind of thing. You know, one Saudi senior prince recently said, you know, what our problem is that instead of using all of our money from oil to educate our people, we went on a five-star tourist trip around the world.
Well, I think it's very convenient to have somebody else to blame for the problems in your country. And
they
think
blame it on the Jews.
And they're going to blame it on the Jews. And the reason that we have problems and poverty problems in Saudi Arabia is because of the Jews. The reason we have poverty in the Palestinian area, despite the fact the West has given billions of dollars to Yasser Arafat, is because of the Jews. And by making them the scapegoats, then you can mobilize the people against them. And there's been really a hatred between two sons of Abraham, between Isaac and Ishmael, going back to the origin of the Arab race and the Jewish race, and I suspect that will be there as long as we live, and we're not going to change it, but I think we have to recognize the hatred that is there, and we're certainly not going to solve it by giving up more land.
No, that's true, and I think especially, Sam, what we have to understand is that anti-Semitism begins with the Jews. This hatred begins with the Jews, but it never ends there. And that's the point of Preachers of Hate, of my book, is that Americans, we need to understand in America that when Jews are killed around the world, Americans are at risk right here in America. Anti-Semitism is the sewer from which Osama bin Laden and his filth emerged. And until we really attack that sewer and dry up the source of that hatred, we're going to have suicide bombers who are going to take airplanes and crash them into places like the World Trade Center. You're going to try to attack Americans around the world.
And I think what's really what I learned from your book is the fact that in the Arab mind or in the Muslim mind, why the Americans and the Zionists are in this together. The Zionists are running it, and they're using America. Therefore, since America has the power, America must be destroyed.
Well, and they hate us especially for the shared values that we have with the Jews. And I think that's the single most important thing. And there's a big surprise at the end of the book. You know, the Muslims say, well, there's a conspiracy. This is a great big Jewish conspiracy. And so I ask the question, yes, there is indeed a conspiracy between America and the Jews. It's called shared values. We have a conspiracy of freedom. We have a tolerance of differences. And from the very start of the American dream, Jews rallied to the flag of freedom. And I think it's very important for Americans to go back and look at our own history and look at how Jews helped the American Revolution and look at the debt that we owe to the Jewish population in Philadelphia when the first soldiers with Washington were starving in that winter of 1777 to 1778. And it was the Jewish community that bailed them out. Anyhow, I tell that story at the end of the book. I think it's something that Americans will be very, very interested to learn about.
Well, that's something we usually don't teach in our history books. But actually, it was one of the Jews who gave his whole fortune to finance the Revolutionary War. And I think
right.
He died an impoverished man.
Pauper,
but
who absolutely.
Believed in this?
That's right. Absolutely right. He died a pauper. But he gained he helped gain freedom for America. And through Freedom for America, he helped gain freedom for the Jewish population.
Well, I really want to thank you so very much. It's been a long day for you. This is the second hour you've been with us. We covered so many entirely different things in the second hour. Anybody who would like to get the first hour, of course, you can get the tapes from us. But you'll want to get this book, Preachers of Hate. A lot of fascinating information in it. I recommend it. We will be carrying the book. So, Ken, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate it. It's been really a treat to be with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Kenneth Timmerman, and I hope you enjoyed the program. And we'll talk a little bit about perhaps the protocols in the next hour. A fascinating document. I have one recommendation. Don't read it. It is truly evil, and until you understand the degree of evil that we're up against, why you can't understand anything that's going on in the world today. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment. First of all, we have to bid adieu to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, and if you'd like a copy of the next hour, of course, you can get that from us here at Radio Liberty until tomorrow when we'll be with you again. We ask you to pray for Radio Liberty and for our provision and our protection. So until tomorrow, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line right now our good friend Dave Wagner. Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. Again, thanks for having me on. I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be talking a little bit in a few minutes about, I think, probably one of the most important interviews I've ever done, and that's my interview with Norman Dodd. But we just got off the line after a second hour today with Kenneth Timmerman and a wonderful book he's written called The Preachers of Hate, Islam and the War on America. And the book really just spends a great deal of time talking about a document called The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which was responsible for the pogroms in Russia in the early years of the 20th century, 1905, the time of the Russian Revolution. And then, of course, it was responsible for the intense hatred of Jews throughout the world for the Russian Tsar, which was quite normal. It would be more or less expected there would be resentment because they legalized anti-Semitism because the Tsar believed what the protocols said. And the protocols basically said that there was a world conspiracy headed by the Jews that brought about the French Revolution, is using masonry, is using secret societies to take over the world, and that they control the media, and they control the banking, and they control everything. And if you read this, you almost see these things happening, and how easy it is to believe the Jews are responsible if you do not understand the true spiritual nature of what we're up against. And then, of course, this document was circulated in Hitler's Germany, and this was really the basis of the anti-Semitism that energized Adolf Hitler. It was, of course, it's being used today in the Middle East by the Arabs to justify their anti-Semitism. It circulates throughout Europe. It circulates throughout America, usually in a brown paper bag. Because if you read this, I will tell you, if you do not understand the spiritual nature of our battle, why, you'll be taken in by this very, very convincing lie. But when you understand that there is control over the banking and money of the world, but it's not controlled by the Jews, it's controlled by the central banks that fit into this whole satanic conspiracy, because most of the central bankers are not Jewish. There is a control over the media. And although some of the people who are involved in the media are Jewish, the majority of them are not, and the great power behind many of these great corporations is not Jewish at all. In fact, if you look at the board of directors of many of the so-called Jewish banks, you'll find that people are there from the Rhodes Scholarships. You'll find Pete Peterson, who is a Greek, but he was also, of course, the director of the Council on Foreign Relations. So what you're basically seeing is anti-Semitism is used as a smokescreen to distract people from what's really going on in the world today. Yes, there is a world conspiracy. It's a satanic conspiracy. These people hate Jews, and I really believe that they hope one day to get the Jews into Israel so they can kill as many of them as they possibly can, and by so doing, they can thwart God's plan for the future. Because Lucifer hates Jews, and until people really understand that, and they understand what's going on, they're not going to be able to do anything at all about what's going on in the world today. Well, would you like to hear this tape we talked about beforehand, Dave?
You mean the entire tape or just some excerpts?
Well, let's go ahead and get started with this tape. This is basically my interview with Norman Dodd.
Sure.
Who was director of the Riche Committee, which investigated the great tax-exempt foundations back in 1953 and 1954. And for our listeners, you must understand that in 1953 and 1954, there were many people who believed that we had communists working at the highest echelons of our government. And these were the times, about the time of the McCarthy investigations. But the reason for this belief that there were communists in our government was because we had turned Eastern Europe over to the communists. And there was no question that we had allowed the communists to take Eastern Europe. We'd made concessions to them. We'd offered to give them the Marshall Plan. We'd given them the plates to print our occupation money so that they could print the money, and then we redeem it. And that's how they were able to finance their occupation of Eastern Europe and the rapes that were carried out there. Almost every woman in Eastern Europe, of age was raped. We never talked about that in America. It was totally blocked out by the controlled media. And then we turned China over to the communists. And there was no question in the minds of the people in 1953 that people in our State Department had withheld intentionally aid from Chiang Kai-shek, even the aid that Congress had authorized, so China would go communist. And so if the only explanation logically, at least from the point of view of most people who didn't understand the Anglo-American establishment and the occult conspiracy we talk about, was it had to be the wicked communists working in our government, and the communists working in the New York Times, and the communists working at Harvard University, that were responsible for the fact that our boys fought and died in the Second World War. And then, of course, we gave up what they'd fought for. They were betrayed and we'd given Eastern Europe and China the communists. And we'd done everything, of course, we could to ensure that Russia would survive the Second World War and continue its oppression of its people. So this was my interview with Norman Dodd. And Norman Dodd is the director of the Rees Committee, a fascinating individual, a great patriot, and what a pleasure it was to have an opportunity to talk to him. So let's just start in the interview. And Norman Dodd, this was 1980, and he was actually at the
And this is Dr. Stan here on Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion. That's going to determine just what the future will bring. Now, we need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of KFER. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and furthermore, we need to remind you that we are listener-supported, and we certainly need your financial support to keep bringing you the message of freedom here on Radio Liberty. If you'd like a copy of any of the tapes of our programs, they're available, and of course, we'll be glad to give you one for nothing, but if you could include a gift of $6.50 to cover the our costs, why, we'd appreciate it. Otherwise, certainly write to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. That's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. And so, without further ado, I want to give you a little background on a very interesting...
Well, I think we'll just sort of fast forward to see if we can get into some of the more detailed information. And that fellow is certainly talking awfully fast there. Maybe we ought to slow down that tape, but we'll have to...
And as a communist in Moscow, he understood communism, and he understood you couldn't trust them, and the last thing in the world...
So we'll see if we can get to the point where you'll actually hear my interview with Norman Dodd. And Norman Dodd, as they say, was, he was about 80 years old when I got a chance to talk to him. And he had been studying what was going on in the world for many years. And that's why he was actually chosen to head the Rees Committee.
And by a carefully coordinated propaganda campaign, they were able to convince many people in the United States that the Chinese communists were not communists at all. Just as a decade later, they were able to convince the American people that Fidel Castro really wasn't a communist. He was the Abraham Lincoln of the Sierra Maestre. Well, basically, the interesting thing about the Institute of Pacific Relations...
And the Institute of Pacific Relations was actually organization, a communist front organization, financed by the Rockefeller Foundation, financed by the Ford Foundation, financed by the Carnegie Foundation, that was instrumental in bringing Fidel Castro to power, bringing Chairman Mao to power. And the question was, why were these American organizations working so hard to promote communism? Why would the organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation be promoting communism? So let's see if we can get to my interview with Norman Dodd.
Democracy and socialism have only one thing in common, that is a word, and that word is equality.
Well, I think that we're not going to have, it would take half the time getting to the point where we're talking about Norman Dodd. Let's just go the important things on the tape that we have, my interview with Norman Dodd. One of them is the fact that Norman Dodd had an opportunity as the head of the Rees Committee Research Division to go to New York and to interview Rowan Gaither, who was the director of the Ford Foundation. And Mr. Gaither, I said, Mr. Dodd, why is the Congress of the United States investigating the Ford Foundation? And Mr. Dodd said, well, because your organization has been funding communist and subversive activities. And Gaither said, well, would you like me to tell you what we really are doing? we are operating under a presidential directive, because most of the people here at the Ford Foundation were in the OSS or the CIA, and we're used to operating under presidential directives. And our purpose is to so alter life in America that one day America can be peacefully merged with the Soviet Union.
Dr. Stan, could I play that clip right now?
Sure, go ahead.
That's what you just said. Here, this is sort of a gravelly voice because he is fairly old, like you said. But listen to what Norman Dodd says.
Well, you're going to hear Mr. Dodd here in just a moment.
Okay, I'm having problems too, Dr. Stan. It was playing good just a few minutes. Oh, I know what's wrong. Here we go. I'll back it up.
All right, well, Norman Dodd is about 80 years old when he's telling
the
story.
Here we go. On arrival,
after a few amenities, Mr. Davis said, Mr. Dodd, we've asked you to come up here today because we thought that possibly, off the record, you would tell us why the Congress is interested in the activities of foundations such as ourselves. Before I could think of how I would reply to that statement, Mr. Gaither then went on. Said, Mr. Dodd, all of us have a hand in the making of policies here. We've had experience operating under directives, the substance of which is that we shall use our grant-making power so to alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union.
And, of course, I sat there in my chair and at the studio there at Bob Jones University in 1980 as Mr. Dodd made that statement. Now, in 1980, that seemed pretty ridiculous, and yet today, as we find people from the KGB working at the highest levels of our government financing Russia, of course, you know that Putin, who heads Russia today, is a KGB agent, our president insists on giving $20 billion to Iraq, not lending it to rebuild Iraq, but giving it to Iraq so that they could repay the money that they borrowed from Russia. Why are we so interested in the Iraq being able to repay Russia? Because the KGB still is in control of the secret police, and they're communists. The military is still under the control of the communists, and I think anybody who really believes that communism is dead, they've been watching too much television. So basically, America is increasingly becoming a socialist nation. In fact, we have more socialism in America today and more of a safety net than they have in Russia today. Russia was never communist. What it was an authoritarian society with a ruling elite, a massive police force that controlled the population. And what's happening in America today? Why we have a two-party system? Both parties controlled by the same people. Both parties pushing ever bigger government with a massive police force and a massive military. And Americans are progressively losing their freedom here. And one day I believe that we will be peacefully merged with the Soviet Union. And the entire thrust of the current educational program controlled from Washington, D.C. is to change the attitude of our children, school children across America, so they will be willing to merge into this world government, which has always been the goal of the communists in Russia. Well, I think that's an amazing clip, don't you?
Well, yeah. The reason I ask, when we talked a few days ago, I didn't understand a little bit of the light. It has come on, Dr. Stan. I've talked to Charlotte Isserby, and I listened to your tapes and some of the other tapes, and finally, like I say, the light came on, and I understand that since 1953, at least, we were very much aware that they were merging both Russia and the United States, and that's why I see it's very important whether we find out whether there actually are two KGB agents, Primakov and Karpov or whatever their names are, working for the Homeland Security, and I believe they probably are, as Elizabeth continues to pursue that through her own senator with no answer after 4 to 5 to 6 weeks. And that, when there is no answer, pretty much I believe that is an answer. And that interview, I could never understand it. Like I say, I finally, the light is, here was a comment from Elizabeth. I know you've always said it's one of the most important interviews, one of the most important tapes you have. Here's her quote about it. It says, of all the books, documents, videos, and audio tapes available to alert Americans of the serious situation facing this nation today, there is none more powerful in the interview with Norman Dodd in the early 80s, a few years before he passed away. So she says there's nothing more important than that particular audio tape. And now that I see what it says, that he's talking about these tax-exempt foundations being used by the White House through directives to merge the United States and Russia, I understand it, because I can see that's what has been happening for the last 20, 30 years. As I show on many of my videos, I show how Gorbachev closes the U.S. bases. I could never understand this love affair, hate affair between Putin and Bush, but now I do understand it, because one minute, you know, I'm reading that they're passing some major treaty. Let me read this quote here. It was 2002. When Putin said, "Together we will counteract global threats and challenge," Putin said, he's talking about the U.S. and America when he's with George Bush back in 2002, and he says here, "We're going to form a stable world order in the interest of our people and our countries," dubbed the Treaty of Moscow, and it talked about the disarming, but then after that, now here's to show the hate relationship, and this is why most of the American people don't have a clue what's happening, and they're very confused, but here's a quote from Vladimir Putin. He announced that a new generation of nuclear weapons with multiple warheads and long-range capabilities would replace Russia's old stock. However, Mr. Putin gave no timetable for the deployment of these missiles. According to Mr. Putin, these are terrible missiles of which we have dozens with several hundred warheads. These weapons are even now in our ready for use.
And not only that, but the Russians now are adopting our concept of preemptive war. We justified our war with Iraq. It was preemptive. We had to strike them before they struck us. Well, if we have a right to attack Iraq and kill the people there preemptively, then we could not object to somebody else using preemptive war. There is no instance in all history to justify preemptive war. Now we have established it, and there's a blowback. And when you establish a new president, you should not be surprised if it's used against you. And the great tragedy of today is the average American doesn't understand that we started financing Russia back in 1918. It was financed by the Federal Reserve System. It was financed by American corporations. It was financed by Henry Ford and certainly by Abel Harriman. It was financed by our great banks. It was financed out of England, and this is so much of this is covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and we give you the references to Professor Sutton's books, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, is a trilogy. Soviet Economic Development, and the whole idea being that we have financed the Soviet economic development since its very inception. But the average person has no idea that these things are going on. This is a great tragedy. So right now we're going to be talking to Dave Wagner about what's going on. The other thing that's important on this tape is that he talks about how talking to the people within the great tax-exempt foundations. It was very obvious that they were using the power of the great foundations to rewrite our textbooks for the schools, to rewrite the encyclopedias, to make communism look very, very acceptable, to push the idea of the United Nations, to influence American foreign policy, to embrace this idea of world government, to undermine religion. This is what it's always been about, the New World Order, the New World Religion. This is 1953. This is 50 years ago. But one of the most interesting parts is where he tells about when he wanted to investigate the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, because he knew that they'd been pushing wars to carry out this whole idea of Carnegie's to bring about the one world government. And so he got permission from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace to have one of his assistants, a Miss Catherine Casey, go through the files of the endowment, Carnegie Endowment, back in 1908, before it was even incorporated. And she was a very liberal individual. She had actually been sent to the committee to actually spy on Norman Dodd and make sure that they didn't get any information they weren't supposed to. But he trusted her, at least to be honest enough, to go through the files over there. He told her what to look for. And she went through the files of the Carnegie Endowment, the minutes, the their meetings in 1908, 1909. In 1908, they spent the whole year figuring out how they were going to change the world. They decided that war was the best way to change the world. And then between 1909 and 1910, they spent the year trying to determine how they would get a war going and how they would get America into the war. Now, in our last hour, we talked and mentioned a lot of people believe there's a Jewish conspiracy because that explains the First World War. It wasn't the Jews who precipitated the First World War. It was these people from the Carnegie Endowment and this internationalist group in the United States and their counterpart in England who controlled the English government at that time. It was a group known as the Round Table, and the Round Table controlled the government, precipitated the war, and then when the Germans wanted to surrender, they wouldn't allow it to surrender because they wanted as much carnage and death as possible. But Miss Catherine Casey came back to Norman Dodd, explained what the Carnegie Endowment was actually doing, and you'll actually hear on that tape, which we have available in our four-tape set called The Secret Government, you'll hear him talking about what Catherine Casey had found. And I think this is really very, very believable, because if you read the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which is based upon the writings of Mr. Rennie Wormser, who was the counsel for the Rees Committee, he tells how the Carnegie Endowment spent millions of dollars to propagandize the American people to get America into World War One. They had millions of dollars at their disposal. They decided the best way to bring about world peace was by getting America into the war. Why? Because it intended to create the world government, the League of Nations. Fortunately, they failed, and we have been able to live as a free society for the last 80 years. How much longer that will last, I really don't know. So, you've listened to the entire tape, haven't you, David?
Yeah, I have, and I would recommend, Dr. Stan, rather than try to explain it all, that your listeners would get a copy of that tape, as well as your, if they don't already have it, the book of the Brotherhood of Darkness. Both of them. If you were to read that book, it's very easy reading, and it covers a multitude of subjects, and it brings you up to date real quick, and it's something you can give away, especially this time of year when everybody's giving gifts away. I can't think of a better thing to give away to your friends if you really love them to find out what's really happening. So, but I definitely get the Brotherhood of Darkness in that tape. Very interesting, Dr. Stan, you're mentioning the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace, and I'm looking at this article here out of the Associated Press, 1996, November 16th, and it says here, Alger Hiss left government in 1946 to take the presidency of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Anybody that knows anything about the UN what his history is, the fact that he was served as the Secretary General when they adopted the UN Charter there in San Francisco, but also that he had connections with the communist government, Russia specifically, and spies, and so he had to leave government, and there's where he ended up at the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace. So,
I think that understanding Alger Hiss is understanding really what this is really all about. Alger Hiss was a communist spy, and that was proven in the perjury trial when he was convicted and sent to jail. But when he was being, of course, charged, there were John Foster Dulles, Dean Acheson, Felix Frankfurter, Supreme Court Justice. Now, Acheson was the Secretary of State, and John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State, and they were all character witnesses for Alger Hiss. Why would they be being character witnesses for Alger Hiss? Because he really, this whole thing of his being a communist was a distraction. What we had to do was convince the American people that it was because the communists were at the highest levels of our government that things were going the way they were. And that wasn't true at all. Alger Hiss was also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Alger Hiss was part of this whole invisible government that controls American society and both political parties. And the whole idea was to create the smokescreen of communism to distract people from what the real enemy was. And they're still doing it today.
They sure are, Dr. Stan, and they're doing it through the developing of an agency called Homeland Security, where they divide the domestic, or they divide the civil agencies along with the military agencies, the Department of Defense, for example, with your civilian law enforcement systems. And if there isn't any more mixture than that's ready to cause us problems, it'll be the Homeland Security. And I believe it's just around the corner. that we will see these things happen, and I recommend your readers catch up real quick if they, or your listeners catch up real quick if they don't already know about all this stuff, because you have some of the best resources there are. For example, just about 2 weeks ago, Tommy Franks, who was a general there in Iraq, says that if the United States is hit with a weapon of mass destruction that inflicts large casualties, the Constitution will likely be discarded in favor of a military form of government. Well, that military form of government is in place right now through FEMA, through the Department of Defense, through Homeland Security, and the plans have been in place for a long time, even starting with some of these Norman Dodd statements, to get rid of the Constitution through the education system, to dumb down the people that they wouldn't understand what's happening, and I think we're now just on the threshold of their finally taking actions on what they had put together over the last three or four decades.
Well, let me just comment on this idea of a military dictatorship. First of all, why would General Tommy Franks, who is the supreme commander in Iraq, make a statement like that unintentionally? He had to know if he made the statement why it would have an impact. And then, of course, if the establishment did not want us to hear about it, they could have simply blacked that out. They could have prevented it from being disseminated on the Internet. They could have discouraged any reporter from reporting it. They could have simply spiked the story. So they wanted the American people to hear what General Tommy Franks said, that there would have to be a military dictatorship if there were other major terrorist attacks here. What people do not understand is this has all been planned long ago. If you go to the Internet and you type in Paul Bremer, Paul Bremer is the current dictator of Iraq. He is from Kissinger Associates. He's that very handsome gentleman who is the high commissioner, the ultimate source of power, American power, in Iraq today. But in the year 2000, he was commissioned to prepare a report. It was called The Current Terrorist Threat. So type in at Google on your computer, Paul Bremer, terrorist threat, and you'll get the Bremer report. It came out in 2000, and the entire thrust of the report is the terrorist attacks are going to come. And when they come, the only way to maintain law and order in America is, surprise, surprise, the military will take over. Now, this is the
Can I answer that question, Dr. Stan, why I believe he said that? Because I believe he said it for a purpose, and I believe Waco was for a purpose. But I believe the government wanted him to say that. It's sort of like a balloon he put out there. And if nobody does anything about it, if nobody speaks up against it, then they'll realize that the American people don't care what's coming down the road.
Well, I think
they've done that many times in Waco. They went into what was at one time a Seventh-day Adventist church. It obviously had changed some of its doctrines. But they went in and burned the men, women, and children, and none of the churches in this country did anything about it. So,
well, we'll be back in just a moment with Dave Wagner, and of course we'll ask you to give us a call, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you have a comment or question about what we're talking about this evening, for Dave Wagner or for me, but we are in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen, because you're not going to hear this sort of thing from Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, those who are such a great voice across America. We're a small voice, but we're going to tell you the truth about what's happening while we still can. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there across America listening to us and you believe there's a problem and you'd like to become part of the solution, we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, you can find out about the Radio Liberty family by just giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then we do hope that many of you will go to our website, which is radioliberty.com. You can actually pull down our programs. This program will be archived. We have a number of archived programs there. And you can actually listen live, and you can call in. We have a lot of people who listen to our live programs on a daily basis on the Internet. Other people pull down the archive programs, but there are a significant number, in fact, a growing number of people who are going to our website to get the information that they're not going to get elsewhere. And then we, of course, encourage people to pull down our newsletters, and I really rather think that our newsletters are unique in the fact that they will give you an entirely different perspective of what's really going on. For instance, who is really behind the anti-Semitism that's sweeping America today? That's our November newsletter. And if you don't have access to a computer and you'd like a free copy of that newsletter and you haven't had them before, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV War. We'd be glad to send you a copy of our newsletter. Of course, we hope that you'll enjoy it enough. You'd want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or at least take the newsletter on a regular basis. But you can always go to our website and pull them down there for nothing if you'd like. Doesn't help us, but we're really primarily in this to help get truth out across America. And feel free to copy anything on the Internet, either the programs or the newsletters, and disseminate them to people. We have a wonderful letter. I believe it was November of the year 2000. Goes into the difference between a republic and a democracy. Most people don't understand. We're not a democracy. We've never been a democracy. We were created as a republic so that the people in government would have to obey the law. The Supreme Court doesn't make the law. The Constitution is the law of the United States, and the Supreme Court is only to interpret, not to change it. Unfortunately, they have amended the Constitution by judicial activism in violation of their oath. Well, if you read my November and December newsletters, you'll understand the difference between a republic and a democracy. And once the American people can understand on this one issue, that they've been able to convince an entire nation of something that isn't true. And the only way you could do that is if you have total control of the media. That's November of 2000. Pull it down.
Right. And I'd say to that, Dr. Stan, I have an article right here.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. And go ahead, David.
I just wanted to comment on the democracy, and I hope you have that Plato quote ready where it starts with democracy and ends with the despotism. Maybe get it while I read this quote. This is 11-7-2003. Bush says, U.S. must spread democracy. This is our president that obviously hasn't read your newsletter and obviously doesn't have a clue of what a democracy versus Republican, or he does, and he's a traitor to this country. But I would recommend, if you have that, I'd like you to read that Plato's quote, how you can start out with a democracy, and you'll end up with a dictatorship. That's their ultimate plan.
Well, I'm sending you the pages out of Bartlett's quotations, but it's very simple. It says, democracies always descend into dictatorships. That's all he said, because Plato had lived under the democracy of ancient Greece, and he said democracies always descend into dictatorship.
And that's the bottom line, Dr. Stan. That's what the New World Order is all about. That's what there's going to be a one-world leader in. And it will be a dictatorship-type leader. That's why we're spreading democracy, and we must spread democracy, as George Bush said, all throughout the world. And we started with Afghanistan and with Iraq, but there's many more countries, as our leaders have said. Donald Rumsfeld said this is just one event in the campaign towards many wars that are ahead. And I believe the other ones are right there in the Middle East, most of them in the Middle East. And then eventually there will be a fight for our own freedoms here. They're preparing to clamp down on our own ability to freedom of speech and freedom of religion in our own country. So they went after. I'd like you to, if you have that quote, I'd like that one too, Dr. Stan, because what they did is they went after the Islamic fundamentalists. They didn't go after just all the Islamic religious leaders. It was the fundamentalists. And you have the statement from Gorbachev, the ex-KGB head, and Maurice Strong off their website?
Well, the statement basically says that we're going to have to identify the people who believe in fundamentalist religions, a Muslim, Christian, and Jew, and exterminate them. That was the exact statement, and that'll be coming in the mail as well.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's, again, part of their plan, as they have a plan. If you haven't seen some of the tapes I put out and some of the letters that Dr. Stan's written, you need to get those, but there's a thing called sustainable development or depopulation, and they're moving that direction through all different methods, And Ted Turner went on to say that he would like to see about 90% of the people of the world exterminated or done away with, because these people are serving this creation rather than the creator, and they'd like to get rid of the virus that's on this planet that's destroying, and that's the people that are upon the planet Earth. And they're doing a fairly good job of it with the war, with some of these wars, and with AIDS, and with the abortion issue. Probably better with the abortion issue than any other, as they're killing 50 million helpless babies every year, the United Nations is, through this depopulation program. But that still doesn't anywhere measure up to the 4 billion that Ted Turner recommended that we get rid of. So,
well,
they have some horrible plans in the future.
Well, people go to my website, they can pull down our population control agenda monograph, which I think is as good as any analysis of what's really behind what's going on today. And there really is a plan to kill off most of the people in the world. Now, you say, well, that really couldn't be true. Well, I simply would refer you to the Georgia Guidestones in Elberton, Georgia, where there on these four gigantic stones in eight different languages, they have what I believe is a Ten Commandments from the dark side. And point number one was maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. Now, this isn't a cult site. They hold satanic rituals, satanic ceremonies there. I've studied this. I've been to the library. I've been there a number of times. And UFOs have been seen hovering over this site. And these are demonic manifestations. They hold their naked parties there. They hold their the witchcraft rituals. And it's all right there in the library in Elberton, Georgia. You go to Elberton, you talk to the people and ask them about that site. Well, the Christians are very, very wary. They don't know who you are, and they're a little afraid to talk about it. Nobody knows who put up the money for this very expensive structure. And, of course, eight different languages. The Ten Commandments are in, and then the capstone in four different languages, Babylonian cuneiform, classic Greek, Sanskrit, and hieroglyphics, carries the caption, "Let this be a capstone to the Age of Reason." Now, what's the Age of Reason? Well, that's a book that was written by Thomas Paine, aimed at destroying belief in Christianity, because that's what this is really all about, this eternal battle between good and evil. And that's why the Ten Commandments that come from the dark side are there. Maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. That means they're going to have to kill off over 90% of the world's population, and they really intend to. And if you read my monograph, I simply quote many people who say exactly that same thing. And we, of course, have copies of the information put out by Jacques Cousteau in an interview in UNESCO Courier in November of 1991, where Jacques Cousteau said, well, it's a terrible thing to say, but we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. Now, had anybody else said that, had Jerry Falwell said that, or Judge Roy Moore, why, they would just lambaste them and demonize them and attack them. But when Jacques Cousteau says that, and he's part and parcel, or he was part and parcel of this whole sustainable development occult movement, not a word got into the general media. But we have the documentation on it. Anybody like to see the article, either in French or in English, why we have it? No question, the people on the insiders know that they plan to kill off most of the people in the world. And you say, how could that possibly take place? Well, how about a nuclear war? How about the fact that we have our troops stationed in the Middle East, and everybody over there has nuclear weapons? Iran has nuclear weapons. They're trying to build more, but they've got half a dozen atomic bombs, according to Joseph Badansky, who is the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism. Saudi Arabia has nuclear weapons because they finance the ones that Pakistan has. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. We are sitting on the brink of, I think, a nuclear holocaust. And the average American has no idea that this could happen. And people say, well, they don't have missiles that can come this far. They don't need missiles that can come this far. They can put them on ships and lob them in from ships on both coasts and coordinate that, and within a matter of a blinking of an eye, why, all of our coastal towns would be gone. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in real trouble. And if you look at beyond this from a spiritual point of view, there's never any instance in all history where a nation has turned against God as America has, and God has not allowed that nation to be destroyed.
Well, Dr. Stan, on a number of occasions you've had a call for action from the listeners, and I hope they take heed to that. You ask them to join the Radio Liberty family there, and I hope they do, because the time is short. There's a day coming when nobody's going to be able to work, when nobody will be able to work, and that's very soon. Edwin Burke said, all it takes for evil to triumph is good people to do nothing, and Jesus Christ said, probably the best anybody could say is, when the salt has lost its savor, it's good for nothing, except to be trodden under the foot of the Gentiles. And we as a church have left our responsibility as stewards over what God has given us in regards to our children and grandchildren. Many of the people go to church every Sunday and they hold their hands up and sing their songs, and they believe that's their duty to worship their Lord and their God, and they have no responsibility as far as the future for their country and their freedoms and liberties. It's called stewardship in the Bible, and we're all going to be held accountable for the stewardship in which we were given. And so again, I would ask the listeners to literally take action. I believe you have probably the best resource library of anybody in the world. I have got a number of tapes, and you carry some of them, most of them, and those things cover the biodiversity. I've been to these biodiversity international biospheres, been to the various Gladstones. There's pictures. I've been to various really detention centers across this country. We have those things set up. So, again, the plans are in place. And it's not a time to cower. It's not a time to be a coward. It's time to stand up and be counted. Because Jesus said, if you confess me before men, I'll confess you before my Father which is in heaven. But if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father which is in heaven. And Dr. Stan, I see people just cowering. I'm not sure whether it's ignorance. God said, my people perish because of a lack of knowledge. Or whether it's just cowards. Because God said, the first reason people are going to the lake of fire is because they're cowards. Second reason is unbelief. Third one's liars. So that's in Revelations 21:8.
Well, let's get your address out. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, I got an 800 number. If they just leave their name, address, city, state, and zip, clear and slow, I'll be able to understand that, and I'll get a resource packet off to them. The 800 number is 1-800-959-1991. That's 1-800-959-1991. And again, there's numerous resources with a lot of, they're all multimedia presentations. These aren't just a talking head. This is literally, many of these documents we talk about, you'll see them on the screen. You'll see clips, throughout the time period. On one of the series I actually have on CBN it was, that where they talked about what a cult is right after the Waco incident. And they said a cult is somebody that homeschools their children. This is Janet Reno supposedly said this, according to CBN, the video report, and somebody that stores up food in their garage, or somebody that believes that Jesus Christ is going to return. A number of things that the typical Christians believe are considered right after that Waco incident to be in that same category that whole Davidian family was, David Koresh and the group down there. So that's why it concerned me, Dr. Stan, that nobody stood up. No churches stood up. They just felt that David Koresh and the Davidians got what they deserved, and the government just saw exactly what happens, how the American people are going to handle these kind of situations in the future when they demonize somebody in the press and then they come after them, even if it means killing women and children. With a gas that's been outlawed by the UN. So.
Well, I think even more frightening, we have a video which actually is interviews with people who talked to the people from the special forces that were sent in to kill the Davidians. And I even have an interview of myself with the mother of Clive, I've forgotten Clive's last name.
Clive Doyle,
he today heads the Davidians, and she, on the very day of the attack, or the day after, she didn't quite remember which, but they got a call, she and a friend of hers, got a call from some gentleman who said, I know who you are, and I'm not going to tell you who I am, but I was watching the back of the compound, and they lined the people up out and back, and then they shot them all. Well, they all had bullets in the back of their head, you remember that, and of course, except for one of them, he had his arm and leg torn off. How did they get torn off? I mean, how did they tear the arm and the leg off? Well, he was run over by a tank when he was trying to escape, and they simply threw his body back in there. I talked to the pathologist who did the autopsy on that gentleman. Not one word about it in the media. The FBI agent who investigated that site said, this is a homicide site. And the people who really understood what was going on realized the Davidians were killed. How do we know that they set the fire? Why, the government said that they had the information. You can even hear them whispering. But who recorded that? Well, the government could never admit that they burned all those people alive, could they? Or they had them shot. And, of course, there was a group of children that were in a silo there, and somebody dropped an explosive charge down there and simply blew all those children up. That was the special forces. But they're hired killers. They're sent in to kill. They were simply carrying out orders. And who was in charge? Why, a man at an adjacent military base. His name was, I think it was General Wesley Clark. Member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Rhodes Scholar, presidential candidate for the presidency of the United States, who is getting, all you need to do is look at the media today, and almost every newspaper I read, and I read three or four a day, will have at least one article about General Wesley Clark. How can it be that he gets so much coverage, and he gets more coverage than all the rest of the other Democratic presidential candidates together? There is an invisible force behind General Wesley Clark. Could it be that he carried out the purpose of the Luciferian so well at Waco and, of course, arranged for the murder? What was he doing as a military officer talking to the civilian police? We have a posse comitatus law, at least we had. The military was never to be involved in police action against the American civilians, but General Wesley Clark was. And nobody seems to be very concerned about that. Have you noticed that, David?
Absolutely right, Dr. Stammett. I think the thing that concerns me more, that's a horrible history, you know, that they'll be able to see on that videotape. But probably more importantly is the lack of action today, because today is the day we can actually do something about what's happening in our country today. And I can guarantee you that America and Russia are merging. The incident in Waco and Oklahoma and World Trade Center were not by accident. They were there for a purpose. And many of our documents and tapes and books actually show what the purpose was. And again, I'm concerned for my own children, obviously. I left a big corporation, and I knew that it would take a number of people all over this country coming together with a purpose of prayer and literally seeking out truth and getting involved politically. But that didn't happen. So I see now that the chains of slavery are being strung around our legs and around our arms. Now that might sound like a strong term, but after you see some of the videos, you'll realize we're very close to that day of tyranny. They're very close to that day where there's going to be a dictatorship that's going to take over this country. And a lot of the Christians will say, well, the Bible told us that was going to happen. Well, that doesn't mean we stand back. We're called to be the salt and we're called to be the light. And when the salt, like I mentioned earlier, has lost its savor, it's become good for nothing. To just sit back and say, well, that's what the Bible, that's God's will, it isn't God's will. It's God's will that none perish. But how many are going to perish? Many are. Straight is the gate, and narrow is the path, and few are going to enter into heaven. Many are going to go to their destruction.
Now, let me just comment, David, that today I think there's a great apostasy in the Christian church. And the listeners out there, if you have not yet seen the video, Diaprax, you need to see it. It's a two-hour talk given by Dr. Robert Klink. He was certainly a speaker at our last conference, but this is a professionally done tape that he did before that, and this will convince you that the church growth movement, which is sweeping America today, the 40 Days of Purpose, seeker-friendly church, this is a diabolical plan that is going to lead people away from the truth into a new religion. And we're going to give up any thought of God being a God of justice or judgment, or that there could ever be God's wrath. This is not the thing we worry about. We certainly don't worry about the afterlife either. You know, all we need to do is worry about, you know, feeling good about ourselves. And I read something today from C.S. Lewis, and he was talking in his book, Mere Christianity. And he said, you know, the Christians who have done the most to help others, you know, in recent times are those who were concerned about the afterlife. And as we begin to get less concerned about the afterlife, we see, of course, Christianity having far less impact on society. And I think that's exactly what's going on today. Because our church, as part of an organized effort coming right out of our Christian seminaries, which were infiltrated long ago by the dark forces, have changed the nature of God. And we no longer talk about sin, and we no longer talk about hell, and we no longer talk about, of course, eternal damnation and the fact that an awful lot of people are going to go there because they've not heard the message of truth and they've not accepted the gift of salvation. And the major problem we have today is that there's been a coordinated effort to change both the music and the message of Christianity. And this is being coordinated today on a massive scale with thousands and thousands and thousands of evangelical churches embracing the 40 days of purpose, which eventually, if you need to understand what this is about, you need to see this video. It will change the way you look at the world and understand the apostasy that is sweeping Christendom. It's called Diaprax, and let me recommend it to you very, very strongly. It's available through Radio Liberty, and of course, then you want to get the various things that David has, especially his amazing clips. It's three videotapes. If you see those, you will never look at the world through the same eyes again.
Again, Dr. Stan, I would just warn the listeners, as in love, that there's a time coming, and unless they have committed their life and bowed their knee to the Lord Jesus Christ, and they know all this information. It's one thing to know all the information, but then it's one thing to act upon it according to God's will. To know the information and not to act upon it and bow your knee to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, well, like I tell people at the presentations when I travel around the country, they're just going to be the smartest people in hell. They're going to know all about these plans as they spend eternity with many of these people that they continually are concerned about. Our job is to pray for our leadership. Our job is to pray for our neighbors and our families. As God said, His will is none perish, like I mentioned. So, and we're to pray for those in our leadership over us, because I would hate to see anybody go to hell, because it's a horrible place. It's where the worm never dies, the fire's never quenched, and there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus Christ, in fact, spoke of hell more than He spoke of heaven. And unfortunately, the churches don't talk about that, like you mentioned. There's no fear of God in the churches. There's a new gospel that's been being preached from the pulpits today, and it just breaks my heart, Dr. Stan, because the gospel's right there in the Bible. The Holy Spirit's there to teach people if they're just willing to listen and let Him teach them and guide them in all truth. And Jesus Christ is just waiting for every listener out there to bow their knee to Him and say, Lord, what would You have me do today? Not my will, but Thy will be done. And that's what my message has been all around the country. First, to tell people that these gods they're serving, their military, their money, are false gods, they're lying vanities, but there is a true God that gives us hope, and His name is Jesus. And I would hope everybody listening would bow their knee to Him and do things according to His will, especially in the hour in which we live. He says, when it's high time we put on the armor of light and we put off the works of darkness, and we truly are in those days that we should have the armor of light, which is Jesus Christ, on it, and we should be submitting ourselves to Him every day, being not conformed to the cares of the world, but being transformed by the renewing of our minds as we fellowship and pray and get into the Word of God each day.
Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, you agree or disagree, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And the great problem is today we're beset by all sorts of problems, financial problems. Our country is bankrupt. It's bankrupt financially. It's bankrupt morally. And this nation has repudiated God. Justice Roy Moore was actually taken out of his position at the Supreme Court, and you really need to read the testimony of what happened, because he said he would not continue acknowledging God, and they kept saying, you mean you would continue acknowledging God even if another official told you you couldn't, and even if a judge told you you couldn't acknowledge God, you would continue doing that? Well, if you were going to acknowledge God as the Chief Supreme Court Justice of the state of Alabama, then you're not fit to sit on the bench, and that's why they removed him. Three times they asked him if he would refuse, if he would continue to acknowledge God, and he said yes, and it was so reminiscent of the Edict of Worms, where Martin Luther was asked if he was continue to say that the Catholic Church was wrong, and he said, here I stand, I can do no other, God help me. And this is exactly what happened, and of course you have never read the testimony of what actually happened. You will, of course, if you read our next Radio Liberty letter. We'll actually give you the transcript of what was said there at the hearings that were blacked out by the media. Ed, how are you doing tonight?
Good. Yourself, Dr. Stanley?
Doing fine. You have a question or comment?
I have a comment article in today, World Daily Today. Church doesn't like Jesus. Survey shows only 9% of Christians have biblical worldview. I'd like to read you three sentences, if I may.
Go ahead.
Only 7% of Protestants overall maintain a biblical worldview, according to the study. Of adults who attend in mainline Protestant churches, only 2% shared those values. Among Catholics, less than half of 1% had a biblical worldview. The denominations that produced the highest proportions of adults with biblical worldview were non-denominational Protestant churches with 13%, Pentecostal churches with 10%, and Baptist churches with 8%.
Well, you know, it was Whitaker Chambers who said that human society is based upon faith, and when faith dies, society dies. Religion and freedom are inseparable, and when religion dies, freedom dies. Do you think that that might have some application to what's going on in America today?
Absolutely. But one thing, I don't totally blame the American public because they've been brainwashed. This brainwashing has been so thorough in the media, in the movies, in the school system. Honestly, myself, I had to go out of my way to find the truth.
Well, I hope you'll get people listening to our programs. Do you think we tell the truth here pretty well?
Absolutely. You're my favorite.
Oh, God bless you. Thanks for saying that. We're going to have to let you go, Ed. We're out of time, but appreciate and you're, that's a very important article. I did see it, and thank you for calling in with that information.
God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, David, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's sort of been a potpourri of material, but all important. But there's no nation in all, or no instance in all history where a nation has turned its back on God and repudiated God, and where our officials have said, why, if you continue to acknowledge God, you're not fit for to sit on the bench. And where is the outcry from our Christian churches? Why, it's condemning Judge Roy Moore, and we find many of our leading Christians, organizations and leaders are condemning him. Some of them are standing behind him, and I credit them for doing it. But it's very interesting to see that some of our so-called Christian commentators and some of our so-called legal Christian organizations are condemning Judge Roy Moore because, of course, he's put himself above the law.
I like to close with a quote from Jesus, at least my part. Jesus said, if you confess me before men, I'll confess you before my Father which is in heaven. If you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father which is in heaven. Praise God for Judge Roy Moore's stance.
God night. Good night, David. Thank you so much.
God
and
bless.
That's exactly what it's all about. We're going to have to take a stand. Those that won't stand up and be counted, we're going to be counted out in this battle. So until tomorrow at the same time, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.